Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Now, if you spend any time on the internet, or in some cases with your dad, you'll know that people's view of climate change isn't necessarily about what scientific authority says. And it's this social dimension of climate change that Auckland University's Nikki Hare and Yvonne Underhill-Sem talked about in the lecture this week. They're with us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Now, Nikki, how and why have we reached this situation where the science depends on your politics?
Well, everything that people say gets absorbed by the listener through their worldview. There isn't a neutral position on the world. So that when we hear about climate change, we think about whether that suits our particular perspective. One of the things I think is really interesting about it is that it almost always involves regulation. And so if you're somebody that doesn't like the idea of regulation, then you're going to be pretty resistant to the idea of climate change because it's very politically incompatible.
So there's no correct scientific view of it. I find that disappointing. Is that just because I'm a lefty?
No, there is some evidence that's much more compelling than others, and I think the great majority of scientists would say that the evidence stacks up for there being human-induced climate change. But what I mean is that when there's little bits of stuff that are saying that might not be the case, when you're listening to it without trust in science or knowing exactly how science works, then you take those little bits of evidence and you make them big in your own mind.
I was in a taxi the other day, and the taxi driver... We got into a discussion on science, on climate change. When I say discussion, I mean argument. And at the end of it, he said, I can't bloody believe that there are actually people out there like you who believe this climate change nonsense. People get very firmly, much so that they seriously can't believe that someone has the alternate view.
Well, and also you've got to remember that people talk to each other and they talk to particular kinds of each other. So I might be somebody that's a bit cynical to start with, and then I start talking to all my mates and they start talking about all the things that they've heard that mean it's, you know, all wrong as well. And so together we sort of create this idea that there's an alternative view.
Can this be compared to a slightly different case, which is people's view of genetic modification? Because that was kind of around the other way. In both cases, you had the science academies taking a particular view, but people, on the basis of their politics, differed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I'm a lefty myself, but I actually don't think the left and the right are any more, straight or pro-scientific than the other. You know, it does depend entirely on the issue. Both sides can get off on a tangent. So that might be an example in which the science is much more conservative, saying this isn't such a risk or whatever, and people from another dimension saying, oh, yeah, it is, because it's got lots of dimensions that don't appeal to the left.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the scientists, depending on the issue and depending on your viewpoint, scientists with climate change, the lefties love the scientists because they're the ones trying to save the world and warn us of the dangers. And on the climate, on their GE issue, they were the ones trying to ruin the whole world.
Well, I think that I really do think regulation is the key thing here. The lefties don't mind climate change because all the political rhetoric is a solution is about regulation. And if you're from the left, then the idea of governments, being part of the deal and regulation and equity and all of those things that go along with it is politically congenial. If you're from the right, it's awful because we don't want, business should have freedom, individuals should have freedom and all of that kind of thing.
So you take the approach of denying the problem.
Well, the thing is, there's always bits of information out there that deny any problem. You know, you can probably still find people that think that smoking doesn't cause lung cancer.
AIDS doesn't exist, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, the point is that there's this huge mass of information, and we just have to pick up and deal with the little bits and pieces that we can. And so even though, to me, in a scientific community, it sort of seems obvious that one should listen to the science, that's not all that's out there. There's lots and lots of other things out there. And the science isn't complete. I mean, it doesn't tell you what you should do. It only gives you a picture of what's happening. So you have to have values and ethics, and all of these other things come into the picture as well.
Well, perhaps we should bring in Yvonne on the topic of what we should do, because your part of the presentation was to do more with development, wasn't it? Can you explain that?
Well, what I'm talking about here is that climate is a real development issue, and I think if you talk to anybody involved in development, they will say climate adds another dimension of complexity. And I think the politics comes in that as well, and especially in relation to the Pacific. When New Zealand and Australia are actually quite close to the Pacific Islands in lots of situations, in terms of climate change, totally different. We've got different resource bases, we've got different ecosystems, we have a different experience of life. And so things are, things split when it comes to climate change, and we're no longer friends with those folk on the side. So it is a development issue. How can we negotiate the things for development outcomes around poverty when we've got this little tense issue going on around what's New Zealand doing about its commitments to reduce emissions?
Some of our Pacific neighbours also have a lot more to lose, don't they?
We have a lot to lose. We have sovereignty to lose. You know, when sea levels rise, the definition of what then becomes a sovereign state is highly, you know, is a huge debate right now. When the sea levels continue to rise at a certain phase, at a certain period, and this is where science comes in, but the implications politically are enormous. Where then do fishing zones start and finish? What then becomes a sovereign state? How much land above the sea does one need to have over a certain period of time? What about decadal shifts?
The Pacific is obviously the biggest point where the developed world, us and Australia, meet a lot of developing nations, isn't it, as well? I mean, we tend to think developing nations being in Asia, being in Africa, that sort of thing, but this is right on our doorstep.
It's right on our doorstep, and people who live there also live here, and there's a lot of movement between the Pacific, and we've all got neighbours who are Pacific Islanders who've got connections to there, and the realities in those countries is that things are getting pretty dire for a whole range of reasons, and they're just compounded by these kinds of environmental conditions, many of which are climate-related.
Are we in New Zealand doing a good job of talking about those two things in the same breath? Because I get the feeling we're not.
Absolutely not. No, we're not. And I think the recent discussions with the recent, actually yesterday, the Minister of Foreign Affairs spoke very broadly at a very long length about the new development program for New Zealand, and it doesn't include issues around climate change. Guess what it includes issues around? Trade.
Yes. Mm. So, Nikki, actually, this is quite a good illustration of the way that political philosophy plays into, you know, the whole approach to this issue, isn't it?
Mm. And it's also really interesting when you start to think about issues of equity and social justice and so on and bring those in here and realise that climate change isn't going to hit everybody equally. And in New Zealand in particular, where there are sort of indications that we might be one of the nations that isn't hit as badly as some other nations, let's just put it like that, it becomes less imperative for us to do something about it, even though there's all these kind of equity issues. So we continue to drive our cars, and that means Tuvalu goes underwater. I mean, what's, you know, is that fair?
One of the things that we often look to developing nations for in this argument is how much they should be doing versus what we should be doing in the developed world. Is it in the Pacific Islands, are they creating much of the problem?
Zero, nothing, never will, never do, never, never did.
No
never
deforestation, that sort of thing?
You know, deforestation is not what caused current climate change that we're getting from today. What caused current climate change that we're getting from today is related to the way in which we became a developing country, the industrialisation process that happened sometime later. So you've really got to put that issue on a side burner.
But it does stop the solution, though, doesn't it?
There's two issues here. One of them is whether you mitigate it. Mm. And whether you adapt to it. Okay, now the Pacific is adapting to that. Part of that adaptation requires using its resources differently. We can certainly play a role in getting, as I say, New Zealand, getting those kind of adaptation things going right. But there's no obligation for the Pacific to mitigate any of the effects of climate change because they were not responsible. And developed countries recognise that when they recognise their obligations to under the Kyoto Protocol, to say we were part of the problem.
Is there any chance of political consensus on this?
No.
Well,
take a look at Copenhagen, take a look at Cancun.
The trouble is, I think, that this does require patience. Like, if you look at the way that information shifts through society, over time, if things are happening, like if global climate change is real and caused by human emissions, that will be recognised by all people of all political persuasions. It's just a matter of how long we've got and how quickly that occurs. So I think there is hope. It just depends on the time frame that you're talking about.
And that has to translate into policy, though, doesn't it, Yvonne?
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to happen?
My first answer is no, not in the immediate future, because, you know, as Nikki has said, there's a time issue here, there's a patience issue here. It's about behaviour change. And when you've got people who are working on a 3-year behaviour change process, which we all know about, the kinds of behaviour changes we're looking for, and the mind is the biggest one, takes a lot longer.
Is there anything to feel cheery about? Because is bringing me down, frankly.
No, don't be brought down, because I think what you should be cheery about is that people do continue to adapt. They adapt in a very sort of, in a slower way. And it's surprising who is adapting. And I think more of us can do that because, it is about, we are making those choices. What we need to be able to do is provide better choices for a wider range of people. And allow them to do those, yeah.
Do we have to take people along with us, though? I mean, there are obviously a large number of people out there that still don't believe it's a problem. Do we just ignore them, or do we try and somehow convince them? What do we do?
We convince them. We convince them by a whole range of ways, and I think there are a lot of organisations that are doing that convincing in a different way, and as Nikki was saying, people's worldviews change. People's worlds are not change, are influenced by a whole lot of things. So the obligation is on all of us. In all our little ways, whether it's in our household or in our family or our neighbourhoods or communities, schools.
And with that rallying cry, we'll have to conclude. But thank you, that was fascinating.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Auckland University's Nikki Hare and Yvonne Underhill-Sem. After the break, robots and the great cinema census.